Ladies and gentlemen, recorded in Fredericton, New Brunswick, Canada, it's time for the Fight Night Picks podcast with your host, Craig Allen.
It's episode number 18 of the Fight Night Picks podcast. A couple more guests for you. All right, let's step into it. Episode number 18 of the podcast, back again. You know, we had a great card this past weekend with UFC 225 from Chicago. You also had Brave CF 13, LFA 42, and there's a lot of good fights coming up this week, too. You've got Dana White's Contender Series starting on Tuesday. That's tomorrow. And there's also ACB 88 on the 16th, which would be on Saturday, among others. So I'd like to thank my sponsors. We've got First Row Collectibles from Winnipeg, Manitoba. Visit them at firstrow.ca and use the promo code FNP at checkout. You'll save the shipping there. We're also brought to you by Sisu Mouthguards. Definitely the best mouthguard I've ever had. Visit them at sisuguard.com and use the promo code FNP10 for 10% off your purchase. So, like I said, two big interviews today. My up-and-comer from this week is actually one of my guests. That's Woodstock's own D-Logue. And I'm also featuring our first two-time guest from the Fight Network and fan-sided Sports Illustrated, Ty O'Keefe. And we're going to break down and analyze UFC 225. So like I said, Saturday morning from Belfast, Northern Ireland, you had Brave CF 13. Main event was a rematch from Brave CF number 1, where you had bantamweight title fight between 10-2 Stephen Lohman and 5-2 Franz Malambo. And I had said pick Malambo to win just because he had worked on his striking at SBG. And since the first fight between these two guys, he had three finishes, one submission and two TKOs. You know, in the fight, Lohman was able to seal the deal. He had multiple takedowns in the last round of that fight, and he was able to secure the unanimous decision win. So it'll be interesting to see what we have upcoming for Franz Malambo. He's definitely an exciting talent in Brave. Also, your co-main event, you had former UFC vet 24-6-1 Norman Park. He was taking on 10-6 Miles Price. They had fought before in 2010, and Park was able to get the win. And I had said take Park, you know, submission specialist. He was able to dominate in that fight and ended up with a unanimous decision win, but couldn't really secure submission from the ground. You know, Friday's episode, I talked about PFL. So just check out Friday's episode if you missed it. I had Gerald Harris on as well as Zane Simon. We broke down UFC 225, but did a lot of focus on PFL. Really interesting tournament format that they have there as well. Touched upon Bare Knuckle FC a little bit. And we had Jeff Houston, obviously the ring announcer for Bare Knuckle, last week as well. So this past Friday night, you had LFA 42 from Branson, Missouri. Main event was Krantz and Kane. I'd said take Kane. You know, it ended up being a split decision win for Krantz. If you watch that fight at all, at multiple points, both guys kind of left their hands low and threw, you know, just bombs. It was definitely fight of the night for that card. And, you know, it was a win for the former LFA champion, Krantz. An exciting fight. And if you get a chance, head on over to Access TV's website and have a look at some of the highlights from that. Co-main event was Jaleel Willis. Got that one right. He climbed to 9-1. Got his first round TKO win over Chellerwin Davis. You know, Willis was able to get up against the cage into the clinch. Set up the win. He got a knee to the head. And it dropped Irwin Davis. And he was able to just... I mean, it was like pinpoint accuracy, the TKO ground and pound. I don't think any of his punches missed Irwin Davis's head. It was a really nice and clean win for him. I mean, he's got a lot of potential. 5 TKOs on his record, 4 decisions, and his only loss is a majority decision against Kyle Stewart, who's 8-0 as a pro. I think he's like 5-1 as an amateur, and the one loss was by decision. And he was also on Dana White's Tuesday Night Contender Series last year. So he also had a lot of boxing fights from this past weekend. Definitely one of the worst fights I've seen in a long time. You had Tyson Fury taking on Saifur Sefery. You know, the Gypsy King, it was his first time fighting since he beat Vladimir Klitschko in November 2015. He had a huge size advantage, and Sefery was 39 years old. He had been fresh, though, and I think he had a fight in It was February of this past year already. You know, the first and second rounds of the fight were total BS. It was all jabs. Hardly any of them landed. Seferi, he looked to push the pace. He came forward, but every time he'd come forward, Tyson would kind of tangle up with him. And the ref allowed it every time. He didn't punish Fury whatsoever. I mean, Fury clowned a lot. And I'd say probably the most interesting part of the fight, it was all over Twitter, was the fight in the crowd at the end of the second round. There were a lot of fans going at it. I saw a crowd video that showed some of the tangle and some of the mix-up. And it distracted both fighters in the ring a couple times, too. And the referee had to kind of hook them up and get them going again. In the third round, Fury went on the offensive. Seferi couldn't really land anything meaningful. And then he retired on the stool at the end of the fourth round. So some people I saw on the internet had asked about a potential matchup between Deontay Wilder or Anthony Joshua with Tyson Fury. Don't kid yourself. Fury didn't look good at all. He didn't have much power behind his punches. I mean, he didn't look like he was trying in the first and second rounds. He was just kind of goofing around. But he didn't really effectively set up any jabs. It wasn't a great fight. I mean, in that third round, he finally started to land some jabs through, you know, Seferi's defenses. But maybe like three or four more tune-up fights before he fights anybody of note. I saw he had a fight scheduled for this August and the opponent's TBA. So keep an eye out on that. But Tyson Fury back into boxing and he got the win. Probably the best fight this weekend in boxing. You had Terrence Crawford taking on Jeff Horn. I said take Crawford. It was a really entertaining fight. You know, Jeff Horn had beaten Manny Pacquiao previously. He was something like 18-0-1 going into this fight. Crawford obviously undefeated. He also had Peyton Manning's favorite play on the back of his shorts, which was Omaha. I thought that was pretty cool. So Crawford definitely won all eight rounds. You know, he weaved in and out spectacularly. He threw effective combos and then, you know, in and out, in and out. He dropped Horn in the ninth up against the ropes and, you know, standing eight referee. Of course, if you're an MMA fan, you'd recognize referee Robert Byrd. He was the one that refereed the Maymack fight. And so anyway, once Horn got back up, Byrd let the action continue. Crawford ran right in and threw a flurry of punches, and then that was enough for Byrd to step in and call it. But Terrence Crawford winning there. Also, I previewed the Trout-Charlo fight, and Charlo was able to win by majority decision. He had two knockdowns in the fight, and he retained his WBC junior middleweight belt. So now it's as good a time as any. We'll get into my interview with Ty O'Keefe from Sports Illustrated Fansided, as well as the Fight Network. And we're going to go over the entire UFC 225 card, as well as focus on your main, your co-main, and an entertaining fight that started the main card on the pay-per-view. So here's my interview with Ty. Your first fight in Ige, Mike Santiago, when I profiled it on Friday, I was pretty confident in Ige. The two of us were kind of butting heads on who was going to... Ige didn't look great against Julio Arce in his last fight. He got outboxed, got beat on the feet, won the fight first round TKO, and he definitely looked like he's improved quite a bit from his last fight.
Yeah, I wasn't sure what to expect from either of these guys. I leaned towards Santiago had a feeling. I was kind of surprised the fight went the way it did, but I was leaning on Santiago for sure.
Definitely. He had a lot more experience.
Yeah, and I tend to lean, you know, these matchups, these early prelim matchups. But I'll tell you something, on paper, at least, and maybe overall, that was easily the best early prelim card the UFC has ever put on. Like, yep. On paper, I mean, that could have produced Demetrius Johnson's next opponent.
Yeah,
between Pettis and Benavidez, if they wouldn't have announced Cejudo Demetrius Johnson rematch during the broadcast itself, which was a huge kick in the face to Pettis, I'm sure.
Yeah.
You know, but yeah, I was surprised with the way that first fight went. I really was. I was.
I mean, Oliveira taking on Guida, you know, you looked at Oliveira's record, he's 2-4 in his last six. It was kind of tough to judge, but I mean, those losses were to Max Holloway, Anthony Pettis, Lamas, and Felder. And he had so many finishes, so good on the feet. I had said, look for Oliveira to get the submission win. He was able to do it quickly in the first round. In my mind, you kind of wonder, well, what's next for Clay Guida? I'm sure he's going to keep fighting in the UFC. Yep. He's still competitive.
Yep.
That win over Joe Lowe's on.
And popular.
Yeah, too. That win over Joe Lauzon, if you look at it, it's two big names, but at the same time, Joe Lauzon is kind of on the decline, so you got to discount that win a little bit.
Oh,
but
yeah.
Good for Charles Oliveira, keeping it going.
Definitely. You know, Oliveira kind of reminds me of a lighter Jorge Masvidal, just in that he's got a lot of experience and he's been in there with big guys, and a lot of his losses have come to big guys, and when he's had that opportunity to fight bigger name opponents to advance through the ranks, he hasn't capitalized on it in the same way Masvidal hasn't. You know, Oliveira's kind of been the same way in a different weight class, obviously. But anytime Clay Guida steps in there, you know you're going to – it's got to be like trying to fight a Tasmanian devil. Like, the guy is just energy, energy, energy. And every time he takes a loss like this – now, he's not 40 yet. I think he was 37, 38.
Yeah,
you always kind of wonder, is this going to be his last fight? You know, this is going to be the last time. But he isn't nearing that level, like, you know, where BJ Penn was at, where BJ Penn got to the point where he was just losing to everybody all the time. And it was like, okay, guys, we got to stop now.
Yeah.
You know, enough's enough. You know, well, BJ Penn, we're not there with Clay Guida yet, I don't think.
With BJ Penn, it was kind of strange because they had him sitting cage side with Matt Hughes. I thought the plan was to give BJ Penn another fight this spring. I could have sworn I heard about that, but now it seems like career's over, but
yeah,
it's kind of in limbo.
And that's for the best, I think, too. I mean, BJ Penn probably should have quit a couple years ago, and the way guys can sustain brain damage when they're dominated like that, you know, and you don't want to. I mean, this was a guy. This is BJ Penn. This guy's a pretzel. He dual division champion, not simultaneously, but you know, he was a pioneer for the lighter weight classes coming up. And I mean, he's fought light heavyweights before. I think you know, like he's fought everywhere. And I mean, so definitely. And I hate that's what I hate about when these guys keep going past the point of where they're even protecting themselves and they're losing and losing early and losing ugly. It's that it tarnishes their legacy that they worked so hard to build.
Well,
you know, it really does.
I mean, why don't we'll skip over and we'll get back to the Benavidez fight. I mean, continuing that train of thought, Rashad Evans and Anthony Smith, it was pretty cut and dry. It was going to be a finish for Smith. It was quick. Evans, what, he's lost five in a row now back to 2015.
I believe so, yeah.
And that was a quick knockout loss. And I saw him on a, it might have been a podcast or television show. It was either today or yesterday. And he basically said, you know, fighting isn't my life, so.
Yep.
You kind of wonder, I mean, the gloves didn't come off. He didn't take the wraps off in the ring, but you kind of wonder if that's it for him.
I won't be surprised if we don't see Rashad Evans again.
Yeah.
He's got other opportunities. He could be an analyst. He's an intelligent guy, you know, and he's got so much experience. Also, because he's kind of, you know, he's been a champion. He's been on tough. He's been, you know, a regular guy competing through the ranks. You know, fight fans are very familiar with this guy, you know, and so I think no matter what, he's going to be not maybe the level of Daniel Cormier, but he's going to be another one of these guys that we see for another 10, 15, 25 years, even as analysts, as, you know, these are going to be guys like baseball's Joe Buck and things like that. You know, we're going to start seeing these guys. We're starting to see a lot more of these older MMA fighters who are not even that old turning over, and it's kind of a new generation is coming in. You know, it's, except for in the heavyweight division. These heavyweights are ageless, I tell you, these guys. But yeah, I won't be surprised if that's the end for Rashad Evans, period. Like, I won't be surprised if he never fights again. Well, and I think it's the right time.
Yeah, and it's kind of similar, you know, Bisping, we were waiting for him to have a fight, and then he just kind of transitioned. And I mean, he's a successful analyst. I like listening to him. Intelligent guy. He's funny. He brings a lot to the broadcast. And, like you said, there's a lot of heavyweights, too, that could transition so seamlessly into broadcasting and other opportunities as well. And for Anthony Smith, he called out Sam Alvey. I think that'd be a perfect fight in light heavyweight for those two guys.
Yeah. Island Sam Alvey, you know, they both come out off wins then, right? Yeah. I mean, I think Sam Alvey just won last weekend in Liverpool, was it? But whenever it was, he just won recently. And, I think that'd be a good matchup. Makes sense for both guys. You know, and you know, Alvey will take the fight. Sam Alvey's never going to say, no, I'm not going to take that fight. So, good opportunity for both guys. Yeah, it would be nice to see that happen.
So, jump back. We had mentioned Benavidez and Pettis. I was pretty surprised. I mean, Benavidez hadn't fought in quite a while, but his only two losses were to Demetrius Johnson and Cruz twice. But, I mean, Pettis looked really good. Great on the feet. Mm-hmm. He double up on punches. And, in my opinion, he'd won the second and the third round. So he's looking for a title shot, whether Cejudo beats Johnson, which is probably pretty unlikely, but he's looking to fight the winner of that, and it kind of makes sense, so be good
fight. It does, simply for the fact that Demetrius Johnson continues to run low on opponents in his own division. That's why we're running these guys for a second. There's so many rematches, and Pettis is a guy who continues to surprise me because, I don't know, he looks so young, you know, and he looks like such a much younger version of his older brother. You know, he's not that much younger than him. But when every time I see him, he improves. Every time he's doing something better than he did the last time. And I was impressed with him. I didn't think he was going to come out of there with the win. I thought Benavidez would definitely use experience and find an opening. But Pettis, you know, he trains with amazing fighters. You know, he trains at a world-class facility. And it's hard to say he doesn't deserve a title shot for beating Benavidez and considering the climate with the division. And also, Demetrius Johnson's already gone his way to avoid fights with TJ Dillashaw and other guys outside of the division. He is so headset on just doesn't want to do it. And that it's come to a point where if Cejudo doesn't beat him again, would be a massive upset if Cejudo beat Johnson in a rematch in August. Who's going to be after Cejudo? It's got to be Pettis. I mean, I can't think of anybody else. I couldn't have think of anybody else this time. There are some new guys coming up in the back of the rankings. There are some new 125-pounders coming up with, you know, ranked 15th to, like, 8th right now within that division. But they're not ready yet. They're not experienced enough yet. And Pettis after Cejudo, unless they want to give somebody a third shot. You know,
the only name I can think of, and if you're not familiar with him, wouldn't surprise me, is ACB's flyweight champ. The talk was Askar Askarov. He's 10-0 now. All of his wins have come by finish. And the talk was once he won his last fight and defended his belt once more, he was going to sign with the UFC. I haven't seen that made official, but he's another person. I would assume even for him, they'd want to have one or two tune-up fights before he goes in there.
Oh, yeah, yeah. So. At the level is, there's the, I no matter, I know ACB is no joke, but it's not, nothing's at the level of UFC right now, except for some Bellator fights, fights. But, they're going to have to find, they do have some new blood come in, like I said, they're going to have to start going out and getting guys like that.
Yeah.
You know, because Demetrius Johnson, he's already not one of these champions who brings in a ton of people. You know, he doesn't seem to, doesn't seem to drop either on social media or like the other guys do. You know, Dana White and those guys have made it clear that he's not the pay-per-view draw that a lot of those champions are. So I think Demetrius Johnson's going to have to bite the bullet and take on a guy like TJ Dillashaw or somebody, you know, from the bantamweight division in order to keep this going, because he's running out of options.
And it's kind of strange because they do market him a bit. I mean, he's in a lot of those Metro PCS commercials. He's at almost every other fight card. You know, you see him and you see Chris Weidman, Forrest Griffin. And when I went to UFC 220, that was the story. I mean, you could go up and you get a picture with Demetrius Johnson or Forrest Griffin. Yep. Really personable guy. I got to meet him, shake his hand, whatever. Nice guy. But, definitely have to have that fight with TJ or at least somebody in the bantamweight division.
And he's a consummate professional, too.
Yeah.
Well. But one of the reasons he's always around is because he's like the PG-type superstar. The UFC doesn't have to worry about him flying off the handle and throwing a folding chair through a bus window.
Yeah.
You know, they don't have to worry about anything like that with Johnson. He's a safe, so is Weidman. He's safe guys to have around that promote the brand and are always going to do so professionally. So, yeah, they're great for the sport because they're good role models for their kids, too.
And Griffin, he's a bit of a wild card, but they keep him around. So
he bleeds UFC.
Exactly. First fight on the prelim, you're talking about Bellator fights. This is more of a Bellator fight. Two guys that were 0-2 in the UFC. Both were knocked out in their two losses. They went out there, and, I mean, they were fighting out of desperation, you could tell. They were looking to knock each other out. It was a good contest, but De La Roque ended up, you know, getting on top, finishing by TKO. So you kind of wonder what's left for Rashad Coulter, but, I mean, he's put it on the line all three fights in the UFC.
Yeah, and Rashad Coulter, every time you think this is it for Rashad Coulter, he pops up on another fight card. It's just when you're just about, oh, I forgot about him.
Yeah.
And I honestly thought he was going to grind out a win. I mean, going into the fight, I just thought, you know, he's so much more experienced than people give him credit for.
Yeah.
But I was kind of surprised that he didn't pull one out. And he's another one of these guys who may, I don't know the status of his contract right now, but you never know. He could end up really ended up in Bellator or anywhere else, you know, because he hasn't found that success in the octagon that you need to stay there. De La Rocha, I don't know. I think in order, if he's going to move, he's going to have to start beating guys bigger than Coulter.
Yeah, like he hadn't fought. He hadn't fought in 2 years. Somebody. Yeah.
Yeah, he's going to have to fight somebody within the next, you know, 6 to 9 months. That's within a, you know, a 15 to 10 guy.
Yeah.
And I think that's going to be his make or break opportunity at this point. Things are getting crowded.
Things are getting crowded for sure.
Fight
after that, you had my up-and-comer, a big prospect that a lot of people knew about. I mean, he was ranked 11th in Mirsad Bektik, taking on Ricardo Lamas, who's on a little bit of a decline where he lost to Josh Emmett. That was a huge upset loss. Bektik got the split decision. I thought that he had won the second and the third rounds. I mean, Lamas had attempted some submissions late in the third, but, I mean, it was a close fight, and it was a good tune-up fight for Bektik to crack the top 10.
Oh, absolutely. And that was his first, I think that's his first big name victory, is it not? And unfortunately, Lamas seems to be at that point where he's becoming some other guy's first name victories, you know, first big name victories as well. And you know, Donald Cerrone's kind of in a slide right now that kind of reminded me of it, except for I got the feeling that Donald Cerrone's going to pull out of it.
Yeah.
Whereas with Lamas, I don't know if Lamas is going to pull out of it. I don't know if he's going to be able to come back and ever be that top five guy again ever. I think right now he is on the decline. There's something missing from his game that used to be there. I don't know if it's the killer instinct he used to have. I don't know what it is, but there's something that just isn't there that used to be there that kept him so relevant for what seemed like a long time, right? I mean, this guy seemed like he'd been around for, but you got to wonder, where does he go from here?
Yeah, I mean, exactly. What
could possibly be next for Ricardo Lamas after that type of situation? I too thought he lost the first and third rounds. I would have been okay with unanimous decision.
Yeah,
you know, some of these split decisions that are coming out are a little shady. You know, I don't know about that. These, I think they just pull it out to, you know, so it sounds different than unanimous decision all the time, because that would have been a good call.
You say that, let's get into one. Regardless of what was said about Halifax today, Claudio Gadelha, Carlos Esparza. Odds were -525 Gadelha, +425 Esparza. I picked Esparza to win. Split decision win for Gadelha. The crowd booed her after the fight. I thought Esparza won the second and the third round. She had more strikes, a better striking percentage. Gadelha landed 2 takedowns in the second and had more ground passes. But, I mean, Esparza landed a takedown in the second and the third. Her striking looked good. As everyone said, and rightfully so, she's been more dynamic, and she's always improving fight after fight. I mean, that loss to Randa Marcos, it was kind of, I almost think, like an anomaly. Or
Randa Marcos is a very underrated opponent.
Exactly. Or it put Esparza in a position where she had to change and had to adapt. And from that, she has. And I thought that she won the fight, but the judges kind of saw it otherwise.
Coming out of tough. When she was the first champion, I honestly had classified her as the most one-dimensional UFC champion I'd ever seen, because she was so wrestling heavy. Her striking was, it was so much behind, you know, her wrestling abilities. And every time she has got better. I noticed on Saturday she was changing levels a lot when she was coming in, and I haven't seen her do a ton of that. You know, but her striking, you can tell she's focused on it. It's definitely improving. And the way she was changing levels was giving Gadelha problems. It was giving her serious problems. This afternoon, I'm sure it's going to be out all over. Esparza accused Gadelha of greasing on the MMA Hour. I heard it myself this afternoon, and it kind of left it there and said, you know, flat out called her a cheater. And going into that fight, I picked Gadelha only because I've been following her. I don't know if you remember, 4 or 5 years ago, there was a documentary series called The Fighter Exchange, and it was on Canadian made. And it was Gadelha and 3 other people from Brazil, from Novo Inhao, and then 4 Canadians. And they went over and trained there. And again, then Claudia Gadelha came back to Canada. And this was back when she was, I don't know how old she was. She was young,
Yeah.
And I followed ever since then because I just found her talent. You know, she was so good on the ground. But I'm really surprised kind of where she is right now. I mean, she did get the win over there, but that everybody expect her to get the win. However, a lot of people don't agree that she won that fight. A lot of people think Esparza won that fight. And, you know, Esparza was definitely more busy. You know, she was more, she was definitely the aggressor, especially in the later rounds. She was definitely the aggressor. And, I don't know. That's a tough, but to get it from Esparza's point of view too, now she probably should have won that fight. And now that's Gedalia is a bigger name. Where does she go? Because that was an opportunity to miss. Is the UFC going to give her a rematch with her possibly? Or, you know, and also Esparza, I believe, has a win over Naomi Yunus.
Yeah.
And submitted her. And you got to wonder if she would have beat Gedalia, would that have put Esparza back in title contention? Because before UFC 225, Carla Esparza was not a title contender in that division, just period. She wasn't. She wasn't. So we're going to have to see. That'll be interesting going forward, how that's going to pan out. Be interesting to see that.
Another interesting spot, Overeem and Blaydes. To my, I look at it and I kind of wonder what's next for Overeem. Is he kind of a gatekeeper in the heavyweight division at this point? I mean, he's been knocked out brutally in two fights in a row. And Curtis Blaydes, I don't know if I've seen enough, but I mean, that last win, you're taking on an Overeem who had just been brutally knocked out. He finally got him down and he was able to pound him with those elbows and get the win. He wants a title fight. To me, I say the winner of Lewis and Ganu takes on Blaydes, and then the winner of that fight would go on to fight for the title. But yeah, it's kind of a rough spot for Overeem. I don't know who he would fight next. You wouldn't dare see him fight Hunt. I mean, maybe he fights Olenek in Russia. I don't know.
Yeah, that's the thing with Overeem. He's gotten to a point where he's fought everybody.
Yeah.
And he still hasn't been able to get to that point where he's a UFC champion. And Father Time is, his icy embrace is waiting for that guy. You know, he does not – Overeem is on borrowed time right now, I think, as it is. As far as Blaydes goes, I agree completely. He hasn't done enough. Even he – because the Overeem he beat was not the Overeem of a year or two ago where he was still in title contention. Yeah. Overeem was not in title contention heading into the UFC 225, and he's not now, and he's not going to be again. And so I completely agree that Blaydes really needs to beat like a top three guy right now to get into this title conversation. And that's going to take either with Verdum out of the picture now too.
Yeah.
You know, that options are seriously limited. And if you're going to, that means either, Ngannou, like I said, the Ngannou, who is Ngannou's fighting again? I can't remember.
Derek Lewis.
Lewis. Yeah. And that's another guy who's kind of climbed up out of nowhere. And you got to think that's a perfect matchup. If Blaydes fights the winner of that fight, as long as he doesn't lose while he's waiting for that to pan out.
Yeah.
You got to wonder if, and I'm not sure when the Ngannou fight is scheduled for. I think it's this summer, isn't it?
It's 226.
Oh, wow. That's coming right up.
Yeah.
So that'll be perfect timing then. That'll work out great. So, yeah, maybe Blaydes won't have to wait then. So, we'll see what happens with that. But, yeah, Blaydes is nowhere. He's got to beat at least one top three to four guy.
I'm
so sick of these guys calling title shots this quick.
There's a lot of guys like that. I mean, we'll get into it with the Arlovski-Tuivasa fight, but there's a lot of these guys in the heavyweight division. They're bringing them in. They're prospects. They've had really good success, but when you're beating an Andrei Arlovski near the end of his career, you're beating Alistair Overeem when he's on a downturn, you're a guy who beat, a Donald Cerrone, let's say, at one point. Not same division, but you're beating guys on a bit of a downturn. You got to kind of discount those wins a little bit. And
absolutely.
It's been tough with matchmaking where they've kind of thrown guys into the fire. Like, Ngannou, he did win some prove-it matchups, but, he wasn't... When he fought Stipe, his cardio wasn't there. So now he's got to go back to the drawing board, fight Derek Lewis, hope his cardio's there, because Derek Lewis has sneaky cardio. And he can last three rounds. So it'll be interesting to see what happens. Exactly. And he has to cut to make 265. So, it'll be a good matchup.
The thing is with Lewis, too, the more he's progressing, the more his cardio and his training and his nutrition and everything's progressing with his success in the octagon.
Yeah.
So we're going to see a more refined version, I think, of Derek Lewis as time goes on, where he's not going to be dragging like he is. Yeah, he can get he can take guys deep in rounds. Surprisingly, he has a lot longer gas tank than people think. But when he's doing it, it's not pretty.
No,
you know,
exactly.
He's dragging around. He's hanging onto the fence. He's gasping for air, and a lot of times he's just been fortunate because the other guy he's fighting is also sucking air.
He got lucky in his Tabora fight. I mean, got lucky in the third round there against Mark Hunt. He got hurt. He hurt his back. I was really worried for him in that fight. And even in the Travis Brown fight, he took a kick right to the stomach, and that had hurt him. And he was even hurt going into the second round. So you got to worry about injuries with him, but cardio's one thing I wouldn't worry about. And
he's got heart.
Yeah, exactly. And going into 226, right now as it stands, I would pick Lewis to beat Ngannou, but that's a conversation for another day.
Yeah, that's another conversation, but yeah, you find a lot of people who won't agree with that opinion. But yeah.
For sure. But your first fight on the main card, I saw you had an article with Fansided, Chick Magnet taking on Mike Jackson. It was a rough and tumble fight. I mean, CM Punk definitely improved, for sure. I mean, he ran in there and he kind of flailed his arms and threw some punches. And Dana White, after the fight, was definitely not in Mike Jackson's corner.
No, nobody was.
He didn't name names, but, I mean, the reason why Mike Jackson's in the UFC is because Mick Maynard. They knew each other from Legacy. He was a videographer, photographer for them. He had a bit of a boxing background. I know they had mentioned 2011, he was a Golden Gloves winner, which, that counts something. I'm not a Golden Gloves winner. I'm not going
to
fight
him. But that's 7 years ago and relevant to this current situation.
But
yeah, he brands himself as an elite striker. He really does. And people were giving him, trouble for giving him a hard time. They said he's showboating, by talking and seeing him explain away why he wasn't showboating or whatever. And, anybody who's seen sports would probably call that showboating. I mean, whatever. He has a right to do it. And if CM Punk doesn't like it, we'll stop him from doing it then. Make him stop doing it. And you had the opportunity to do it, and he didn't do it. Now, CM Punk, I didn't like his whole transition in there strictly because he wasn't one of these WWE guys who had an actual wrestling background, or some sort of athletic background. This guy's more like a beefed up Broadway entertainer. Yeah. You know what I mean? He doesn't have an athletic type background. And he immediately was training with Rufus Sport, which is, again, a world-class facility. So he's so fortunate. And the sparring partners he has and the time they put into him and the opportunity he was given, I can see a lot of guys coming up not pleased with that because, they don't get the same type of exposure. They don't get the same type of opportunity. Here he is on a main card fight, especially this time around when Overeem and Blaydes was bumped. And I know Holly Holm and Megan Anderson was supposedly put in their place. But a lot of people think that if CM Punk wasn't around, then Overeem Blaydes would have main card opener. That would make more sense. So was he James Toney? No. I mean, he did so much better than that, and a lot of money. There was such an obvious improvement between his first fight with Mickey Gall and what we saw Saturday night. But if he's going to continue, it can't be in the octagon. The UFC needs to cut ties with him permanently. He has no value in terms of, I don't think anybody bought that pay-per-view just to watch CM Punk at this point. And, they had documentaries about him doing the training and all this stuff like that, and he still fell flat.
The documentaries, I had mentioned it, on Friday. I mean, they showed him wrestling on the mat, and I mean, you're getting it from me. I don't have a wrestling background. Yeah, but just watching him roll around on the ground, he didn't look like he had much of technique.
Yeah, he looks like I've seen high school wrestlers with better movement, And I think it's just best. I'm also not a fan of. I'm not one of these guys who think Brock Lesnar belongs in the UFC at all either. I don't want him around. I don't want him back there. But this guy, he had his chance. He had two opportunities over an extent. They were extremely patient with him.
Yeah.
They let him. They gave him every opportunity. Well, that's over with now. So if he fights again, let it be in a much smaller promotion, and move on, because enough's enough. He's taking opportunities from other people who deserve those opportunities and who are talented enough to capitalize on those opportunities. Get rid of this guy. I'm done with him.
The two main takeaways I had from the fight were that He was in a position on the ground he could have gotten out of easily. All he had to do was kick out or stand up, and he could have got up. There was no guard. It wasn't a butterfly guard. He was down on the mat, and Mike Jackson was down on his knees, showboating and then throwing a few punches. And to that point, Joe Rogan threw out the theory that maybe Mike Jackson was taking a dive, and he was just letting the fight continue. And
carry him.
We talked a little bit at length last weekend on the Friday podcast, but you don't see a lot of that in North America. You don't see a lot of, you know, fake fights, rig fights, whatever. But that, I don't know if I believe in it, but at the same time, it went on for longer than it needed to.
Yeah, I will never think, I don't think Dana White would ever allow a fight to be fixed. If something went on between the two camps, you know, I don't think that there'd be enough people that would agree with it to make it actually happen. I think there's one thing in MMA that outsiders don't understand is that there's a lot of integrity in the sport.
Yeah.
These guys bust their ass to fight in the sport, right? So, you know, I don't think there would ever be a fight like that. However, I do think that, you know, Jackson carried him, and I think he did so because, you know, he wanted his time in the spotlight to last a little longer, and rightfully so. Hey, that's his, you know, that's his second shot, and he knew he needed to make an impression. Now, did he make an impression? Yeah, but it probably wasn't the one he wanted to make. Being known as the guy that, you know, CM Punk took you the distance, you know, like that's not a cap in anybody's feather. He's a smooth talker, and you know, he's great at operating like that, but there's not enough of a draw with his ability in front of a microphone and his ability in the octagon to make that something viable moving forward, something that's going to make the UFC keep him around. So you got to wonder, is UFC going to have him back? Is he going to get shoved down to Bellator? Who knows? You know, I don't know. But all I know is that CM Punk, when he, like you said, when he was getting dominated on the ground, his legs sometimes were barely even moving.
Yeah.
Like it's like he wasn't even fighting. You know, when a guy gets on top of you and he starts trying to submit you, or he's got you in the rear naked choke or whatever, everybody knows you use your hands. You fight the hands. You know, and he just still looked like a 10th grade, you know, a 10th grade wrestler who barely got to wrestle, like a JV wrestler.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I think that the best thing that Mike Jackson has done is ended the CM Punk, you know, era. But he may only be known for that unless things change significantly for him in the future. So be interesting to see where he goes next. I have no idea what the UFC could match him up against. And did you notice, after the fight, I read something, and he said, can I compete with some of these guys in the UFC, or can I beat some of these guys? Of course I can. Well, that's not really the mindset of a successful UFC fighter. Most of these guys and men and women think, yeah, I can beat anybody. This guy was just saying, you know, he wanted to reaffirm that he could even compete.
Yeah,
you know,
exactly.
That's not, you know, so yeah.
I'm
done with CM Punk.
I think, you know, Mike Jackson, there's probably still a spot for him in LFA, whether it's taking pictures or being in the ring. And if he wants to come back to the UFC, go down to LFA, have a few fights, and then we'll see what happens. But yeah, end of the Punk era,
yep.
Maybe start of the Tuivasa era.
Maybe.
I was surprised.
UFC would love it.
Yeah, I was surprised he ended up getting a decision win. I thought it was either going to be a decision win for Arlovsky, or it was going to be a finish by Tuivasa.
Yeah.
He'll most likely break into the top 10 with this fight. I think he won the first round. I think he won the third round. Arlovsky had the second. It was a decent fight. I'm sure he can work on his gas tank a little bit more. But
yeah.
Good for him to go all three rounds, too. I wouldn't take that from him. I mean, all of his wins, yeah, he had 9 knockout wins and 9 fights going into this. I wouldn't be disappointed with a decision against Andrei Arlovsky at this point.
No. Arlovsky is one of those aging heavyweights who is continuing to force the world to recognize him as a relevant heavyweight. You know, he's not fading like Fedor is. You know, he's still doing a lot of damage, and he's still a formidable opponent, especially for a guy like that. And he's a great – it's for a guy like Tuivasa, who has limited octagon experience, stepping in to face a guy like Arlovsky is a learning – you know, you're going to learn all night, but it's a – big fight for him, because you testing yourself against a guy who has been tested against everybody. And you know, I think Tuivasa has got to worry about his gas tank, but minus the shoeies, you know, drinking the beer out of his shoes and all that disgusting, horrible stuff. I like what I see from him, and the UFC is sure put a push behind him. It seems like,
yeah.
You know, they really want this guy to succeed. I don't, you know, whatever he's, but what I've seen so far is great. But next, it's going to be his next fight that's going to be the test, because it won't be against a guy like Arlovsky. It'll be against the top 10. It's got to be against the top 10 heavyweight. And then, and only then, will we know what he's capable of, what Tuivasa is going to be. His next fight is going to be big, big, big for his career, regardless which way it goes.
In your next fight on the card, it was a prove-me fight. I was kind of caught up in the hype. I thought there was a chance Megan Anderson could have got the win, just based on length. You know, if she got on the ground, I figured she was going to get back up easily. Kind of like a Neil Magny. You know, you get Neil Magny on the ground, with the exception of RDA, he gets right back up. Longer fighters typically do that, but wow, Holly Holm, I mean, she looked dynamic. She had new tricks. I mean, I figured, you know, you train at Jackson Wink, you practice the same three-punch combo with a kick at the end, and that's it for the rest of your career. You don't learn anything new, but yeah, old dog, new tricks, good ground game.
Yeah.
She was able to keep position too, which was great to see.
Going into that fight, Holly Holm needed a win so badly. Losing 4 out of 5, it's not indicative to the fighter she really is. If someone were to just look at Holly Holm's record prior to that fight, they would think this is crazy. This woman's in trouble, whatever. And it's so, those fights, the Cyborg loss was close. The Randami fight could have gone her way. She was submitted by Misha Tate in the last, few minutes. And but when she went in there, I was so worried initially, because Megan Anderson looked initially like she was really going to give Holly Holm some trouble the first few minutes. I mean, there was some times you could see it. And it's the first time that Holly Holm had ever faced anybody with that reach advantage on her, and somebody, or in the UFC at least, and somebody who was taller. And when they actually squared up against each other, you could see a significant size advantage. I mean, it wasn't Rocky Drago, but it was significant. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And when Megan Anderson, I was very impressed with Megan Anderson, her striking ability. She's lost on the ground, though. She's absolutely lost. There were so many times that someone, even a mid-level grappler, could have exposed Holly Holm. But that's the thing. Holly Holm has gained so much knowledge, and she's so intelligent, and she's gained so much experience that she's not a striker anymore. She's not just anything anymore. She had amazing top control, I thought. Because Megan Anderson is experienced enough. I mean, let's face it, she was the Invicta champion. You know, so Megan Anderson's not like she's coming off the street and whatever. She hadn't fought in a while coming into Saturday. But still, you know, Megan Anderson knows how to use those long legs for leverage to get someone like, off. And she could not move Holly Holm off her many times. That's something we haven't seen from Holly Holm a lot. We haven't seen a lot of ground and pound from her. Usually it's head kicks and just nasty striking, and that's what she's amazing at. But man, another dimension to her, and after Saturday, I don't know how anybody could say that she's not the top bantamweight contender, regardless if it was a 41-45 pound fight, I don't care, and the top 104. She's top contender in both divisions right now.
For sure.
And now she's won 2 out of 3, and she isn't going anywhere. I think, and she also owning the most historic win in women's MMA history is something which she's always going to be known for. But I think we're going to see a new chapter of Holly Holm where, let's face it, between Cyborg and the biggest fight to make right now in women's MMA is Cyborg Nunez.
Yeah.
As far as I'm concerned, that's the biggest fight. Get Nunez to go up to 145. Fight, go from there. That would be a nasty war. I hope it happens. Fantastic. Holly Holm is no consolation prize. That would be an amazing fight as well. And those three right now are making the world go round in women's MMA. That's where everything begins and ends.
It's great to see fighters, reinvent themselves at some point. I mean, like you said, when she fought Cyborg, I couldn't believe how well she did clinching up against Cyborg and didn't let her throw her around. She held her own in that fight against Jermaine Durandamy. I am of the mindset that I think she won that fight, regardless of the punches after. Yeah. I think she won that fight. Going into this fight, this was Megan Anderson's fight to lose, because the idea that the UFC had was, Well, Megan Anderson's going to fight Cyborg for the title just straight out of Invicta. Well, now she's had this little bit of a layoff. Let's tune her up and put her up against Holly Holm and hope she wins, and then she'll fight Cyborg for the title.
Yep.
You're right. Yep. Holly Holm, not totally reinvented herself, but she just keeps learning, keeps trying new things, and they've been working for her. So, yeah, it'll be great to see what Holly Holm has next.
And the one thing about Holly Holm that is so underrated is that during this, where she lost 4 out of 5, okay, she didn't bury herself. She didn't hide. She didn't get down. You know, I've always been very critical of how Ronda Rousey handled her losses. I think that's ridiculous, especially for the way that she treated a lot of other fighters when she was dominating.
Yeah.
Whatever. But Holly Holm is not only a perfect example to young women coming up in MMA, but just to any fighter. I mean, she didn't say, oh, you know, poor me, whatever. She didn't stop. She didn't want to take any time off. You could even say that possibly the losses to Tate and Shevchenko had something to do with the fact that she rushed back into the octagon a little too soon.
Yeah.
After, you know, a previous loss. If the refs would have deducted those two late hits from GDR, Durandami, she would have won that fight. She would have been the first women's featherweight champion in UFC history. And anybody who thinks that Holly Holm is irrelevant or whatever. However, I will say, when she beat Beth Correa last August, everybody was like, oh, she's back.
That fight shouldn't have gone that long. Slow
down. Yeah. I was like, slow down. You know, like, beating Beth Correa is not, you know, Correa is relevant because there's not that much depth right now past the top 5 people. You know what I mean? But if you think about it, Cyborg has never been tested before except for from Holly Holm. Holly Holm's the only test Cyborg has ever had in her entire MMA career. The only woman who's ever gone up there and smacked her in the mouth and said, let's do this. You know, I'm not going to back down from you. So, yeah, Holly Holm has a very, very bright future, and she's going to be around a very long time.
Bright future. And now there's a lot of question marks. RDA versus Colby Covington. You kind of wonder what's next for RDA. I saw a lot of people asking that question on Twitter. I'm going to run through some of the stats just so I can get them out of the way, and then we'll get into it. So the striking total was 105.99 RDA. Takedowns were 7-3 for Colby Covington. RDA had 2 ground passes. Covington had 1. Covington won the fight, in my opinion, because he pinned RDA up against the cage. But if you go into the fight metrics side of things, RDA landed 30% of all of his strikes in the clinch. He had a better striking percentage in every round. Covington went 7-18 for takedown attempts. RDA went, he didn't have as many, but I think his percentage might have been a little bit better. I had rounds 1-4 for RDA. Round 3 was kind of arguable, and somehow, I'm not an MMA judge by any means, I'm not a professional MMA judge, but Sal D'Amato scored at 49-46 Covington. I don't know what fight he watched, but apparently he had the same glasses on that Joe Rogan had on.
Yeah.
Because that broadcast, he influenced it just like he did at UFC 223 with Khabib and Iaquinta. Oh, Khabib doesn't look good. His boxing's no good. His chin's up in the air. What's he doing? And when he said that, Khabib had thrown 3 straight jabs to Iaquinta's face that damaged him significantly.
Oh, yeah.
He called Khabib amateurish as well. So in this fight, they did the same thing with RDA, and I thought RDA did a pretty good job of striking. And when he was faced in tough situations up against the cage against a Division I wrestler, he handled his own. So I didn't think it was as cut and dry for Covington as everyone else thought. But at the same time, I think Covington more than likely won 3 of the 5 rounds and got the win.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, and I, you know, Dana White said the same thing. I expected RDA, he's so well-rounded, I expected RDA to give Covington so much trouble because I don't believe that Covington's win over Damian Maia was what people say it is. He fought a version of Damian Maia that is nowhere near his prime.
Yeah.
And if you look at Covington's resume heading into UFC 225, he hadn't beaten anybody except Maia. I mean, nobody. You know, nobody relevant. Nobody
Dunghyun
contending.
Kim, that win too. I mean, it went to decision. Yeah, like, if he was really going to do something, win that fight.
But Covington did win, in my mind. He was the aggressor.
Yeah.
He controlled the fight. He controlled the tempo. He controlled. He took the fight where he wanted it, when he wanted it. And the one knock against Dos Anjos that I've always had is that RDA doesn't have that killer instinct.
Yeah.
He doesn't have that go in for the throat. I'm going to finish you, you know, blah, blah, whatever. He just doesn't have it. And I don't know why, but he doesn't. And Covington took advantage of that and won simply because he was the aggressor, I think. You know, like, he just controlled the fight so much. The optics where how could you score that fight anywhere else after watching him constantly smother him, throw him against a cage, try to take him down? And I was disappointed that RDA didn't go at him with more of his BJJ. You know, like I thought he was going to utilize his jiu-jitsu a lot better. He also seemed to turn away from standing and trading with Covington, which I don't understand why, because Dos Anjos should be away. You know, no, I have no problem standing and trading with a guy like Covington. Covington's striking has improved. You can see it.
Yep.
You know, it's improved. He's hitting a lot harder. His accuracy is up there. You know, he's getting a lot better. These interim titles are a joke in my mind, especially when Woodley is coming back within the next month or two. I've heard August. And now he's calling out Woodley, and I saw Woodley today say, you know, Woodley, he's never wanted to hurt somebody as bad as he wants hurt Covington. And it's interesting because they're both American top team guys. And, you know, I don't know that they don't work out in the same gym or whatever, but they're both under the same kind of banner in that respect. And I hope that fight gets made very soon. But at the same time, these interim belts, man, they're watering down, and they're detracting from the value of the actual belts. You know what I mean? They're taking away from the significance. If the UFC were to just say, okay, this is a number one contender fight and branded as that, promoted as that, whatever, and leave this interim, you know, temporary title crap out of it, then they would have just the same amount of draw, because there would be the same amount of people who would want to be the number one contender than there would be value having an interim belt. Unless a champion is out for, you know, 6 months plus, you know, with an injury, whatever, and there should be no more interim belts, because I feel like it's just the UFC's way of trying to add value to a pay-per-view.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, a title fight. Yeah, that's what we'll make this. But at the same time, there's a big part of me that doesn't think, despite the fact that Covington's got this belt now, it's a big part of me that thinks he should have to beat somebody like Robbie Lawler, even though Dos Anjos was a top-ranked contender. I realize that. I think you need more than two wins over top 10 guys to get a title shot.
Yeah, that's totally fair. And,
you know, especially in a deep division like that, we're talking, look at this division. I mean, this is one of the UFC's deep. There's no shortage of contenders. I would love him to see him fight Till. I think Till would give him problems. I think Wonderboy would give Covington some real problems, because Wonderboy is such a disciplined striker. And that's something that Covington is nothing like. I think that Thompson would give him just nightmares. But so I think until he tests himself against either Wonderboy, Till, Lawler, I don't think he deserves a title shot. But he's going to get one.
Yeah, he's going to get one. It could be a tough fight to watch. It could be
ugly.
It could be weird. It could either go straight to the ground, or they could be defensive and try and strike. I mean, in my opinion, I think Woodley is better in every aspect. It's just going to depend on how that shoulder holds up from surgery. And
we've seen Woodley take shots in the face. We know Woodley's chin. He you know, he was a target board against Wonderboy. His chin is there.
Yep.
And I don't know, when have we ever seen Covington get hit that hard? We haven't.
No.
And exactly. And Woodley hits like a brick, from what I understand. And so you know, if Woodley's the one to fight him, that's the way it goes. I think we'll see that fight regardless of whether we want to or not. But yeah, it could be ugly. It could be very ugly.
And then as far as what's next for RDA, like you said, there's so many different people he could fight. He could fight Wonderboy. He could fight Lawler. He could fight, he wouldn't fight Magny again, but there's lots of, you know, top 10 and guys.
There's also, you know, gatekeeper role or not, whatever, you know, there's somebody that's got welterweights coming up that would love to use him as a stepping stone.
Yeah.
And, you know, I know Dana White, I think, has come out and said he doesn't want RDA to fight at lightweight anymore. And I know getting up there in age, it's harder to make that 155-pound limit, but we can't rule it out.
Yeah.
It wasn't all that long ago that RDA was a lightweight champion.
Yeah.
You know, and last year, he was, in my mind, probably the fighter of the year.
Yeah.
You know, because he won all those first three fights at welterweight against decent guys, and he made that transition so seamlessly. From lightweight to welterweight, it's like overnight the guy was a welterweight, legit welterweight contender. He doesn't get near enough credit, but man, did he miss an opportunity on Saturday.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I had him winning that fight. I figured, you know, mm-hmm. with with his well-rounded striking and his submission skills, I figured if Covington took him down, or if he even had thought about taking him down, it would be over. But good for Covington to clinch against the cage. Didn't really let the fight go to the ground for too long. And it was a smart fight for Covington. You got to give it to him. He's definitely improved.
And now he gets to go to the White House.
Yeah.
You know, he's going to the White House. He's going to go see Donald Trump, bring him his belt. So, hey, you know.
Yeah, his belt and no Canadian dairy.
Yeah, exactly. No Canadian Q-tips either, I think. Yeah,
nothing. Your main event, we went over it a little bit. Hard-fought battle. I think you had described it in one of your articles as a war. It was one of the best fights I've seen in a long time. It was great. It was a great matchup again. Joe was still of the mindset that Covington totally destroyed RDA in the fight, so he wanted to see a rubber match for some reason. I don't see that fight happening. I think Yoel goes up the light heavyweight, and he could go on a run there. I mean, it's a thin division, so I don't see him beating Gustafson, but, you know, you put him up against, like, a Glover Teixeira, Ilir Latifi, somebody like that, he'd win those fights.
Yep.
And for Whitaker, who knows what this injury could do to him. I mean, hopefully it's nothing. You know, he broke his thumb, and it's a shame, but at the same time, broken thumb, and then a bum knee, and then he has the stomach issues, so you gotta worry for him. I mean, like you had said earlier, he's a young guy, but those injuries take their toll.
Yeah, and he was really sick. He had this virus thing, I know, really, really wiped him out, and it kind of even sounded like it scared him a little bit, and that's understandable, I know from experience. But, you know, Romero, I don't think he's going to have he shouldn't even have a choice at this point. I know he only missed it. I think he hit 185.2, I think was when he weighed in, and it's like, okay, 2 ounces, this is ridiculous. At the same time, you know, if he's missed twice, he's 42, he's going to continue to struggle. He's got to go up to light heavyweight. He just has to. I think that should be a rule that they institute in weight cutting. And if you miss three times, then, you know, you're suspended or something, to cut down on these gigantic weight cuts that people are trying to do. Plus, when both guys are trying to cut down that much weight to get an advantage, there's such little advantage to gain. It's not worth what these guys are doing to their bodies. However, the fight itself, I mean, you couldn't have asked for more as a fight fan. Nobody in the middleweight division can sit there right now and say that those aren't the two best middleweights on the planet.
Yeah.
I don't want to hear this stuff about Musasi. You know, I good for what he's doing in Bellator, fantastic. But there's a reason he's doing it in Bellator and not in the UFC right now. So it is what it is. But, Romero, I won't be surprised. He's going to be out at least, I would say, 3 months. I mean, it was hard to come back. Plus, that's your main weapon. I can't imagine having even the confidence to hit again with full force after that heals. That's going to take time mentally to get over that. And this isn't a guy who's an elite wrestler or grappler. This is a guy who leans on these hands to make his money. And just to get the confidence enough even to wrap it and then start hitting a bag without – and then while you, even if you get that confidence, re-injuring a hand like that is so easy.
Yeah.
You know, so they really got to be careful with this. And his coaches really – and I'm sure they will. They're fantastic world-class coaches. But I'm sure they're going to have to really just hold him back, because a guy like that wants to train. He wants to fight. But he's going to be his own worst enemy while he's recovering, I'm sure. But in terms of what's next for Whitaker, even, you got to kind of wonder where he goes from here. I mean, he's the undisputed champion. Nobody can say anything else. I don't want to hear this George St. Pierre stuff, because, you know, you come off for a one-off fight against a guy. It's just not, no. He's a career welterweight. Leave it at that. So I'm interested to see where both of them head next. It's hard to say, but Romero should have to fight at least somebody at light heavyweight and see how it goes. At least one fight. But in Whitaker, man, I don't know. Would it be Rockhold? You know, would it? You got to kind of wonder. And also, timing's going to make a big, big difference, and it's going to impact who he fights next as well, right? It's going to be who's available, all that type of stuff. So we'll see. But yeah, we got our money's worth. It was an absolute war.
Yeah.
And that's what we wanted, right? I mean, that's what we wanted. So,
you know,
we got it.
Three bad cards, in my opinion, in a row. Utica didn't really deliver. They hardly even filled the stadium half full. Mm-hmm. Chile wasn't great, and Liverpool wasn't great either.
Uneventful.
Exactly. So, and kind of touched on it on Friday, but I think the plan from here on out is probably the smaller fight night cards, and then your pay-per-views are just completely stacked. Your fight pass prelims this weekend were great, and things will probably continue like that. But yeah, UFC 225 definitely delivered. You got 226 to look forward to with DC and Cormier.
International Fight Week, yeah.
Stipe, yeah. And Holloway and Ortega, another great fight too. So
yeah, International Fight Week this year should be great. I love how they just go crazy on that stuff.
Yeah.
And we have three fights, the Ultimate Fighter finale as well, I believe will be during that time. And yeah, it's kind of disappointing. The next 2 weeks are going to be real quiet in terms of big time MMA. I know there's always lots going on in the minor leagues. Guys are still, you know, taking care of business down there all the time. But I noticed the next Bellator card as well. You know, they're lacking for star power, and you need that. And that's horrible compared to what they've been doing.
And it was kind of tough with the guys I've talked to. You know, you've got a card, I think it's June 27th or 29th roughly, and then you've got another card July 13th, and then the next card after that I believe is in August in Rome.
Mm-hmm.
And fights haven't totally been confirmed for them. I know having Gerald Harris on, I mean, he's an Oklahoma native. They signed him for a reason, and they have him on the undercard of a fight in his home state. So
it's
kind of questionable matchmaking at this point, but usually with Bellator, the card kind of comes together at the last minute and they're able to salvage something. So shouldn't be too bad. I mean, we're not going to get to see Krokop for a while, but it's something, something will materialize for sure.
Yeah. It's going to be, I think Bellator right now, their biggest problem is they're going to have to get better at managing how they spread out their stars. You know, like the way they overloaded NYC last summer, I'll never stop whining about that. That was so short-sighted. And I told Scott Coker that when I asked him last summer, I said, what are you going to do to keep people coming back? And, you know, he had the typical response or whatever, but it didn't happen.
Yeah.
You know, and the biggest fight Bellator can make right now is Musashi McDonald.
Yeah.
There's no joke about that. There's no denying that. I think Rory McDonald will melt that guy. I really do think he'll be a two division. Rory McDonald is such a talented fighter. And I also think Rory McDonald will come back to the UFC at some point in the future because he'll top out.
Yeah, for sure. Totally agree with you.
That's all there is to it.
Wow. It was great to have you on for a second time. We'll surely have you on again.
You're doing great things over here, and I'll come ramble whenever you ask me to. I love rambling over here. It's great.
Awesome. Thanks again.
No problem, man.
Awesome interview there with Ty. Great to go over the card. It was one of the better cards, obviously, from this year. And it gives us a chance to look forward to UFC 226 with Stipe and DC, as well as Max Holloway and Brian Ortega. And, you know, some of those heavyweight matchups, they're kind of, you wonder what could happen at the top of that heavyweight division, whether the winner of Ngannou and Derek Lewis ends up fighting for the title. You've got Volkov up there at the top. Curtis Blaydes wants a shot as well. So really interesting stuff there. Definitely like to thank First Row Collectibles again. Head on over to their website, firstrow.ca. Check out their selection. They've got MMA autographs, wrestling memorabilia, hockey cards. The list goes on. You head over to their 50 cent bin. You can see meat cards. I mean, there's a Grady Sizemore Expos rookie card in there. Some Andy Moog and Wendell Clark signed cards. They've got a huge selection of sports collectibles, autographs, old episodes of magazines like old 60 Sports Illustrated. So for our listeners, enter the promo code FNP at checkout for free shipping. And remember, prices on that site, they're all in Canadian dollars. So to our American listeners, you're probably going to save about 25% if you order from First Row. We're also brought to you by Sisu. You know, I've had a Sisu mouthguard for a number of years now. And of course, I tell the story every week, but the one game that I didn't wear my mouth guard playing hockey, I lost my front tooth. It cost me probably about $1,000 running from work to the dentist and back again. You know, if you go with Sisu, you can drink when it's in, you can talk when it's in, you don't gag. They offer a $35,000 dental warranty that's good for 1 year, and they'll cover any out-of-pocket expenses if you get hurt while wearing your mouth guard. So if you head on over to sisuguard.com and enter the promo code FNP10, you'll save 10% off your order. It's definitely a lot more comfortable than any of the other boil and bite mouth guards that are out there. Very thin. I mean, if you're in MMA and you want to do an interview or you want to talk to your corner people, it's a way better alternative to what's out there. So sisuguard.com, promo code FNP10. All right, now it's time to get into our interview with D. Logue. You might recognize him if you're from the Maritimes. He's fought in Elite One. He's also fought for LJAC Promotions. 3-0 as a pro, 6-0 as an amateur. Here's D. So D, current LJAC Promotions lightweight champ, eh?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
And in three professional fights, you're 3-0, eh?
Yep, 3-0, and I had them all in this last year.
Oh, nice. And 6-0 as an amateur, am I right?
Yep. 6-0. It took me a long time to get the 6-0 record. It was just, I had a lot of things fall out. I had a full year of, like, dealing with injuries and people pulling out on me, and it's difficult to lock down an opponent in this area sometimes when you got a decent enough record.
Was there any chance that you can fight in Nova Scotia? I know they kind of had a ban on MMA for a little bit, but are there any promotions down there currently that you could fight for?
Not right now. Currently, I'm pretty sure that we had like the same kind of issue where like they go through their boxing wrestling commission.
Yeah.
And I think the promoter there rubbed their boxing wrestling commission the wrong way, so they pulled out completely. So they're in the process of building like a mixed martial arts commission like we have in the province. So Everybody from Nova Scotia is coming up in New Brunswick to fight because it's the only area in the circuit.
And I mean, in your last fight, you got a chance to fight Adam Hazelton. I mean, a Titans MMA guy. You know, TJ Grant heading that gym there. What was it like training for a guy, you know, from Titans? I mean, they've even got Gavin Tucker in the UFC. So what was that like?
100%. I took him as the highest level guy that I've ever fought. I think it played dividend to train that way. It's always smart to train that way. I've underestimated people in my past, thinking like that they weren't quite as skilled, because I've had people like in my amateur career that came in and just fought me like on their first fight, and I thought, oh, this guy, I'm gonna smoke him. I had four fights, I'm gonna smoke this guy. But no, definitely not. Those are usually the toughest fights, the ones that I've taken a little bit lightly. Like, I don't train any less, but it's your mentality going in. Like, if you think that you're safe in a certain area and you're really not, it's not, it doesn't pay any, it doesn't help you at all, that's for sure.
You know, you're facing a tough guy from Titans and Adam Hazelton, 5-1 as a pro. And I mean, you got him into an early clinch up against the cage. I saw a video of it on YouTube, pretty grainy, but I mean, you got him up against the cage, you dumped him with the takedown, he started to get up, you were able to work the scrambles, get into back mount, and then you got the rear naked choke as he was getting up. I mean, it was a great first round submission. So going for a fight like that, like, what do you train for specifically against a guy like that?
I train all areas, you know. I put a lot of hours into the boxing club. I go to the boxing club and I work with like Brandon Brewer. He's one of the higher level guys. Nathan Millier helped me a lot in this training camp. Me and him, actually, I did more rounds with Nathan Millier than probably anybody else. Like, he really helped me out a lot for the stand-up realm. I go over to Evolution Kickboxing. I kickbox over there just to do some, like, make sure that I'm getting in there with kickers. I was kind of worried about maybe his high kick, but he didn't really have really that much on it that night. It just didn't give him the opportunity. And I also always train jiu-jitsu. Plus, I was working with Clint Kingsbury, and he's an excellent wrestling coach, grappling coach. Not just wrestling, but that's one of his, like, definitely his fortes is the wrestling, but he's just got such good grappling knowledge, some good clinch work up against the cage. Like, my plan was to kind of dirty box him up against the cage and tire him out in the first couple rounds, because I knew he hit hard. And it just didn't actually have to happen. I once I got to his back, it was easy, it felt like. But
so you're not just strict with synergy training for BJJ. You go all around town, eh?
Definitely. Anywhere that I can train, for sure. I'm from Woodstock here, and I'll train some there's a boxing club down here, and there's some jiu-jitsu down here. I've been doing a little bit of jiu-jitsu and boxing around here just because when I'm in training camp, I'm super focused, so I make sure that I travel to Fredericton every day almost. But where I'm not in training camp right now, I'm just lifting weights and keeping myself in good shape around here. So it's saving me a little bit of money on the gas.
Yeah, I mean, it makes a lot of sense. It's, I mean, like an hour drive each way from Fredericton to Woodstock. Exactly. So when you're fighting with LJAC or Elite One in the province, how do those contracts work? Is it usually just a one-fight contract that you're on?
Yeah, that's how I try to do it, one fight every time. I don't really want to lock myself into anything, because my big goal is to make it to the UFC. So if I can find a bigger organization that like TKO, or I'm looking at NEF, I'm looking at the Fighting Alliance, it's going to be in St. John, I'm looking at that. They're pretty open. Like Mike Fitz is my guy, and he's the one that actually I get the promoters to go through. I just say message Fitz, get a hold of him, me and him talk about it, and then we always pick matchups. Like I'm pretty down to fight anybody, you know what I mean? But we just talk about it and discuss it. He's kind of like a manager in a sense, but you know, not exactly a manager. He's more like my fight promoter.
Yeah, I mean, TKO, they do a really good job in Quebec. They seem to have a lot of shows around the province. And then NEF, like you said, I mean, if you watch the Dana White Looking for a Fight show, you know, that's how they found Devin Powell. So NEF produces definitely a lot of good talent out of there in New England.
Yes, exactly. That made me so much more interested. But, man, it was like probably 2 years ago. It was right when I was when I just had won my amateur. I was going to go fight the amateur belt. It was out of Halifax, actually, Nova Scotia. Okay. But I was going to go to NEF and make my pro debut, but it was against a guy. I wish that opportunity would have came through. Somebody he had to pull out or something. It just doesn't – stuff falls through so often, but I wish that would have came through because that would have been my first pro fight, and it would have been a really good start to – it would have been more like in – 2016 as opposed to 2017 would give me a year jump, but that's all good.
So on the horizon, do you have any fights booked coming up in the next few months?
There's nothing right directly in the horizon. The LJAC card, I think they're going to have something in the fall, so I want to defend the belt in fall. I'm looking for that August card. Hopefully I can get on to that August card. It's a Fighting Alliance in St. John. There's an NEF card in September. They don't have a 100. They did. They're just having a card here next week, actually. So I messaged them up and asked when their next card is, and it's supposedly in September, early September. That would be perfect timing. I'd love to get on that card. But
well, what about October 27th, Moncton?
Oh fuck, I'd love that too, man. I'd love it. Like that's why I'm trying to scramble to get fights right now, because like if I can get noticed, you know what I mean? Like 3-0, I just feel like is a small record. And I don't know if they'll look at that, but because I'm number one in lightweights and maritimes, they may look at me. So I'm just trying to stay ready. Like for that October 27th is when, to me, I'm going to try to build my camp. Like I want to get a fight in September, so I'll be fight ready for September. But then I want to after that point, just be focusing on that card. Even if I haven't get picked, there's potential for a short notice fight. There's potential for anything, right? And being in the area, number one Canadian, or not Canadian, Maritimes guy on Tapology, so I feel like that would give me a little bit of recognition, but 3-0 is the only thing that I'm worried about. If I could get another fight 4-0 and another quick finish, it would be perfect.
Yeah,
you know what I mean?
Well, I mean, going into the fight, like, you've got a 9-0 record total, 6 amateur, 3 pro, so you're pretty good there.
Yeah, it does say that on Tapology, too. I got a 9-fight win streak, so we'll see what happens. I'm pretty sure... I just want to stay ready for it, but I haven't got any anybody talking to me or anything like that. So I don't know. It's just a waiting game, and I'm staying ready. Right, I want to be in the best shape I can be for that. And even if I don't get called, I'm confident within the next. If I can keep my record undefeated within the next 4 or 5 fights, I'll be getting a call anyway.
Awesome, man. Well, I mean, keep it up for sure. Keep your chin up. You got a great record, and I'm sure you know UFC will be calling soon.
Yes, sir. That's what I'm working towards anyway.
All right. Well, where can people find you on social media out there?
Right now I'm on social media, just on Facebook, really, actually, D-Log. That's pretty much all I really do is Facebook. I got a person that's going to be on my social media, so they'll probably get me going on the Twitter and the Instagram. But I don't do it myself. It'll all be somebody doing it. They'll be taking videos of me and stuff. But I'm not begging on that. That is the social media and the pitcher game. But, I mean, it's going to be important for the career. So I'll just have somebody run it and come in and shoot videos and stuff. I'll be probably getting a lot more hype closer to September because I want to try to push for that UFC card. But I'm waiting to hear things right now. I'm not trying to, like, push myself super hard, like, oh, I want to go to the UFC and all this, just because I really don't feel like they're going to look at me super hard, but I'm staying ready and keeping myself in shape. But like I said, it's only going to be 4 or 5 fights for me, I feel like, if I can stay undefeated to get into the big show anyway. So I'm not trying to rush it just because that card's coming to Moncton. I don't feel like if the opportunity's there, you always capitalize on the opportunities, but there's no sense forcing stuff because I'm still developing. I'm still working, and my skills are going to be there for sure. I'm actually planning a trip to train with some higher level guys at American Top Team, and I just want to see where I stand with all them as well too.
Awesome. Well, thanks so much, D, for coming on the podcast. Hopefully, we can have you again.
Yeah, thanks a lot. Nice talking to you, brother.
Great interview with D. You know, he's an up and comer in New Brunswick, and we'd love to see him, you know, possibly in the UFC when they come here for the event in Moncton in October. All right, so I'm going to do something a little bit different this week. I'm going to profile some of the fights that are coming up during the week. You know, you've also got M1 Global 94 on Friday at 1 o'clock, and the plan is to have a podcast out early Friday morning or late on Thursday so I can preview those and have the fights ready. But just so that I'm not kind of saying the exact same thing on Friday. So tomorrow... Actually, I'll preview this. You've got Dana White's Contender Series 2018, week 1. You got five fights on that card. Probably the biggest fight of note is former NFL player Greg Hardy taking on former NFL player Austin Lane in a heavyweight showdown. You've also got Will Santiago on the card versus Kevin Holland. Montel Jackson at 5-0 taking on Rico DiCiullo, who's 9-1. Chris Curtis, 18-5, taking on Sean Lally, who's from New England. And then you also have Alonzo Menifield at 6-0 taking on Deshaun Boatwright. So I harped at one point about Greg Hardy. You know, doesn't have any professional fights. He's got some amateur fights with LFA. All three fights have ended by first-round TKO. I guess he fought LFA 33 here in February. He also fought in Rite of Passage and Rise of the Warrior, so in those organizations. Trains at ATT. I don't have too much respect for this guy. You know, I've heard Dana White come out and say before that if you place your hand on a woman or whatnot, you have no place in the UFC. But I think it's ridiculous that he's even involved in this contender series. I think it's a joke. You know, he's looking at it as redemption, but I don't know if I've ever really seen him apologize for his actions. He was more concerned about getting back on the NFL playing field than apologizing for what he had done. Whether it was true or not, he was convicted, and then on appeal, the woman in question didn't show up to court, so she's, I mean, I wasn't there, but I would assume she was nervous about going to court for that. So, got thrown out. Greg Hardy played a little bit more football. Nobody wanted him. And now he's into MMA, and Dana White's giving him a shot. So, Hardy taking on Austin Lane. Lane's 4-0 as a pro. You know, he's competed as a pro since 2017, early 2017. Fought for Combat Night, Battle at the Beach, and Warfare MMA 18. And he's won all of his fights as well by first round KO or TKO. And then if you have a look as well, all five of his amateur fights he won by first round knockout or TKO as well. So that'd be 9 on his record, first round TKOs. So Austin Lane, the only odds I've been able to find on the fight are for just that fight. And actually, it's dead even. They're both minus 120s in that. So two knockout heavy guys, Greg Hardy and Austin Lane. And yeah. Probably a lot of people rooting for Austin Lane tomorrow night. All right, so that just about does us for episode number 18 of the Fight Night Picks podcast. I'd like to give a shout out to the Sound of Violence podcast for featuring us as a new up-and-coming podcast you should listen to. And definitely go check them out. They're on iTunes. You can find them on Twitter as well, at the Sound of Violence. So we'll be back again, whether it's Thursday or Friday, like I said. A couple more great interviews on tap. And I'm really excited. There's some good things going for the Fight Night Picks podcast. So we'll see you again later on this week.